Call this meeting to order, redistricting meeting. Thank you everyone for being here. Somebody like to move the minutes from our last meeting?
Someone, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vanderson will move the minutes. Somebody's read them, I'm sure. All in favor of the minutes?
Aye.
Not by saying aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion is approved. Mr. Gehring, you ready for your presentation?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Proceed, please.
Mr. Chair, members, Matt Gehring from the House Research Department. What I'm going to do today is to walk through sort of a basic background in the voting rights as part of the U.S. Constitution, as well as part of as sort of a history of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which I'm sure you've all heard of. You should have a handout in your packet that has all of the PowerPoint slides that I'll be going through. What I'm going to be doing is going through fairly quickly and just sort of introducing you to a lot of the concepts that...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Could you speak into the microphone? I'm having trouble hearing.
What'd you say?
Is this better?
Thank you. Mr. Gehring, proceed.
What I'm going to be doing today is sort of walking through a history of the Voting Rights Act, but sort of with an emphasis on sort of advice for you as a legislative body. I'm going to talk about what constitutes a valid challenge to the Voting Rights Act, but kind of give you some suggestions on what things you can do to sort of minimize the risk of a challenge, because presumably in this context, you're interested in the Voting Rights Act is making sure that you're complying with the act rather than necessarily filing a challenge to an enacted plan. So what I'm going to do is give a very quick overview of the history and then talk about some practical applications of how the act works and what you might want to look for when you're actually designing a plan yourselves. So before we get to the actual Voting Rights Act, just some basic underpinnings of the U.S. Constitution. The right to vote is primarily found in the 15th Amendment, and it's not actually a right to vote. It's a prohibition in the U.S. Constitution from a state abridging or denying the right to vote for any one person on the basis of their race, color, or previous condition of servitude. This is a constitutional amendment that was ratified in 1870, right after the Civil War. In 1868, the 14th Amendment was ratified. 2 years prior to that, the 14th Amendment is the one that people typically refer to as the Due Process. It contains the Due Process Clause as well as the Equal Protection Clause, which you hear a lot about. The Due Process and Equal Protection clauses are the primary provisions of the U.S. Constitution that are used to file challenges related to civil rights types of violations. So the 14th and 15th Amendments, when they were first ratified, were designed to make sure that mostly people that had previously been enslaved had the right to vote. But as the history of our country developed, it turned out that enforcement of the 14th and 15th Amendment wasn't quite working the way that it was intended to. And so by the time we got to 1965, after a fairly significant amount of debate, Congress enacted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was intended to be a new mechanism to enforce the constitutional right to vote as written in the 15th and the 14th Amendment. Since 1965, there have been 4 different major amendments to the Voting Rights Act. In 1970, there's a temporary ban that was enacted related to qualifications for voting. In 1975, the ban on a test as a qualification for voting was made permanent. The Voting Rights Act at that time was also expanded to cover language minority groups. Previously, it had covered only groups, racial groups within the coverage of the Voting Rights Act. In 1982, the Voting Rights Act was clarified to provide that an intent to discriminate is not required for a violation of the Voting Rights Act to occur. So in other words, if you enact a law that actually has the effect of discriminating against a particular covered group in the act, regardless of whether you intended that discrimination to occur, you could still violate the act. And in 2006, there were some amendments that were made to clarify Section 5 of the Act, which I'll talk about really briefly in just a minute, but actually doesn't apply to any jurisdiction within the state of Minnesota. So the major provisions in the Voting Rights Act that apply to redistricting, there's 2 of them. One is Section 2 and the other is Section 5. The Voting Rights Act as a whole is a much broader federal law that covers not just redistricting, but other types of election and voting process requirements within the country. But Section 2 and Section 5 are the 2 sections that will affect you as you're going through the redistricting process. Section 2 requires, basically prohibits a state from denying or abridging the right of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race or color or because of their status as a member of a language minority group. Section 2 applies to all jurisdictions within the country. It includes states as well as cities and townships and other political subdivisions. So any unit of government within the United States is subject to Section 2 and can be subject to a challenge if their redistricting plan is enacted and it violates the requirement of Section 2. Section 5, as I mentioned, is the second provision of the Voting Rights Act that affects redistricting. This is a section that doesn't actually have any applicability in Minnesota. Basically, just for some background, Section 5 requires certain covered jurisdictions to have all of their changes in election law, including redistricting plans, to be to go through a process of review and pre-clearance from the U.S. Department of Justice. These jurisdictions are typically located in, primarily in the Deep South. There are some scattered local cities and local units of government that are covered, kind of scattered throughout the United States. But as I said, the state of Minnesota is not subject to Section 5. There are no political subdivisions in Minnesota subject to Section 5 right now. So we can all be very grateful for that, because the process for getting changes pre-cleared by the Department of Justice is actually quite cumbersome and quite complicated. But here in Minnesota, we don't have to worry about that. So Section 2, as I mentioned, I'm primarily going to talk about Section 2 today. Section 2 prohibits denial or abridgment of a citizen's right to vote on the basis of race, color, or membership in a minority language group. And as I mentioned earlier, the intent to discriminate is not required to state a violation of the act. A claim for a violation can be filed by the U.S. Attorney General or any affected person to enforce Section 2. Typically, what happens if someone's going to file a suit under Section 2 related to a redistricting plan is that they're going to claim that the districts that were enacted, or the set of districts that were enacted, unfairly reduced the voting strength of a minority group. Sometimes this is referred to as vote dilution.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gehring, has that ever happened in Minnesota?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't think there have been any significant cases under Section 2 in Minnesota, at least at the state level, and I think part of that may be because typically our redistricting plans have been court-ordered plans, and so there's less of a risk of violating Section 2 because the court is going through the process of creating the plans themselves, and they use in their principles a principle that says that they, when they're drawing their plans, they'll comply with Section 2.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Gehring, on the 1991 plan, did it occur?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I guess I'd have to check and make sure. I think that there were some technical suits that were filed, but I don't recall if there was a Section 2 claim in the process.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So to make a successful challenge under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, there's a multi-step process that a person has to go through. There's a case called Thornburg versus Jingles from 1986. This is a U.S. Supreme Court case that basically laid out the requirements for somebody to bring a suit under Section 2. In that case, the court said that a violation occurs if the minority group does not have an equal opportunity to participate in the political process and to elect candidates of their choice. And this is kind of a theme that we'll see throughout the standards and as we go through the presentation here today, sort of an opportunity for minority groups to elect candidates of their choice is kind of what they're looking for compliance with Section 2. So in order to actually state a claim, the Jingles case set out this multi-part test for a plaintiff to set out before they can successfully move forward with having a set of redistricting or set of districts being changed. First, a plaintiff has to show that the minority group that is alleged to have been unfairly diluted is sufficiently large enough to constitute a majority of the population of a district and geographically compact enough so that it makes sense to actually draw a district that includes that population or that group within a reasonably sized district. The second requirement is that the minority group has to be politically cohesive. So in other words, if the group itself is sort of scattered in his political leanings, it doesn't always vote for the same particular point of view in an election, it may not be politically cohesive, and so including them all within one district may not necessarily represent the actual, it may not actually help that minority group elect a candidate of his choice because they may not have a candidate of their choice. if they're politically divided. So in order to state a claim under Section 2, the group has to have some political cohesion in the way that they vote. Thirdly, in order for a claim to be filed under Section 2, it has to be shown that block voting by the majority population within a district typically defeats the favored candidate of the minority group. This is typically referred to as racially polarized voting. So if you have a big population of white residents in a district that always vote for one candidate of their choice, and that candidate is never the choice of the minority group within that district, then you could have block voting and racially polarized voting. If you show that, then you may be able to move forward with a Section 2 claim. So if a minority group comes and makes a Section 2 claim and succeeds in showing that they in fact are large and compact, and that they vote as a politically cohesive block, and that their preferred candidate usually loses in an election, then there's an additional step that they must take to prove that the Section 2 has been violated. The court is going to take a look at the totality of the circumstances to find out whether a new set of districts is appropriate within the context of the complaint that was filed. The Jingles court said a whole bunch of factors that have to be considered considering the totality of the circumstances. As I mentioned, these factors are really sort of context-based and fact-based based on the claim. Mostly, courts can be looking at whether there's institutionalized discrimination. So is there a history of animus or actions against the group that would lead to sort of a discriminatory effect within that area? They'll look to whether candidates that are preferred of the minority group have historically been elected to office or not. If it's shown that even though the minority group is a minority within a district, their candidates still can win an election, then it is likely that the court's going to find that there's not a violation of Section 2. But if there's a history and a pattern of minority candidates consistently running for office and losing at some point in the process and never being elected to office, then you could have a Section 2 violation.
Mr. Gehring, I have a question for you. Under bullet point one there, the first one, it says a history of institutionalized discrimination. Can you give me an example maybe of some type of action there that might exist?
So the institutionalized discrimination, the test itself is not too specific. I mean, it's going to be sort of looking at not just previous years, but sort of previous decades and seeing if the area that is being challenged has a history of discrimination in any form against the minority group. So I guess I don't have a specific example of a type of discrimination, but they'll look not just to election-related issues, but in housing or employment or other types of issues where there could be discrimination against the group. The court, if they find that discrimination, they'll be more suspect of the way that the district has been drawn if it has a discriminatory effect against that group.
Thank you. Proceed.
And the third test for the totality of the circumstances that I've sort of highlighted here, as I mentioned, there are several others, but these are kind of the big ones. The court will look at the proportion of elected offices members held by members of the minority group relative to the proportion of the minority group in the population as a whole. There's not a right in the Voting Rights Act for a minority group to be represented in the exact proportion that they exist within the population. But if the court finds that there are some members of the minority group that have been elected and have been successful in running campaigns, then it is less likely that the court is going to find that there's a Section 2 challenge. So in the context of this committee, of course, your concern is not filing a challenge and being successful in the challenge. Your concern is wanting to defend the plan that you're ultimately going to enact either later this session or next year. So some suggestions on what can make a bad district or where vote dilution claims usually arise. There's sort of three kind of contexts that we typically will see vote dilution claim under Section 2. First is where there are multi-member districts. This is something that's not going to be directly relevant to the legislative redistricting process because all of our districts are single-member districts. But for local units of government that might have at-large seats for city council or school board, they'll have to be concerned about this. There's just a potential for vote dilution in a multi-member district if a small minority population is consistently outvoted for all the at-large seats by a majority within a big geographic area. There also can be concern about Section 2 violations where you have single member districts that are either racially packed or racially cracked. Packing and cracking are sort of terms of art within the redistricting world. And instead of trying to explain what they are, I actually have some illustrations that will hopefully sort of give you a visual idea of what this means. well, first start with racial packing. Packing basically is the idea that you're concentrating a minority group within one district so that they have the ability to elect somebody within that district only, but then the surrounding districts are substantially comprised of members of the majority group. So you might have the ability to elect one person, but not a number of people. So this is the example here. Hopefully you can see the color on the slide. So we have a population of green and purple dots. The green dots are the majority. There's 20 of them. The purple dots are the minority group in this population. There are 16 of them. And the examples I'm going to use here just it will be fairly obvious, but these are fairly simple examples just to kind of give you an idea of the concept. There's lots of sort of nuance and complexity that goes into figuring out whether, you know, how you're going to draw these boundary lines and how they work and whether they're going to be compliant with Section 2 or not. But this is just the examples to give you an idea of what packing and cracking looks like. So if we took this population and divided it up like this, you can see that there's one central district where there's 9 purple dots. So the purple people will have a very good chance of electing somebody of their choice within that district. But then if you look at the other remaining 3 districts, the purples, purple dots are in a substantial minority, including being outvoted 8-1 in the sort of northeast quadrant there. So what has happened is even though they have 48% of the population of among all the population, they will only likely be able to elect one of the 4 seats in this legislature. So typically, if you see something like this on a map, the court is going to be suspect that there may be a Section 2 violation if all the other standards for stating a claim can be proven. So cracking is sort of the opposite from packing. Cracking is when you dilute the minority group into multiple districts so that they can't elect anyone in any of those districts. So again, we have the same population here with the purple and green dots. And if we divide it up this way, in a way that actually looks a little more compact and a little more orderly, you'd find out that now the purple minority group is outvoted 5-4 on each of the 4 districts. So assuming that there's racially polarized voting going on in this area, it's likely that the purple group won't be able to elect any members to the legislature because they'll be outvoted consistently 5-4 each time. So this is an example of cracking where you've divided out the minority group and spread them out so that they don't have effective voting power in any district within the area. Again, this is a type of map that could lead to a court being suspicious that there's a Section 2 violation going on. So what can you do to minimize the risk when you're creating new districting boundaries? Here's an example of how you might take that purple and green population and create a set of districts that might be more competitive and more compliant with Section 2. If you just made them into classic boxes like this, you have 2 very competitive districts and 2 districts that are likely to be dominated by one group or the other. Depending on the totality of the circumstances, again, going through the whole set of analysis that I mentioned earlier, there still could be a claim of a violation of Section 2 under this set of dots, but it's more likely than not that because there are competitive districts here and because you have the minority group with a substantial opportunity to elect a candidate of its choice, that a Section 2 claim will be denied. So other suggestions for minimizing the risk of a challenge under Section 2, as I mentioned, try not to pack or crack a minority population. But you do have to consider when you're doing that the context of the surrounding district. So you can't tell if you're packing or cracking by looking at one district alone. You do need to look at the whole map and see where minority populations are and how all the districts are drawn in context with one another. There's also the possibility that you're going to find areas of the state where you're going to have no choice but to pack groups into one area. Particularly, you might find this in Minneapolis or St. Paul, that just because of the demographics of the area, you're going to have districts that are going to have substantial numbers of a minority group, and it's going to be a high number. It doesn't, just because that there's a high number of minority people within a district doesn't necessarily mean that it's packed, and it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a violation of Section 2. You always have to look at the context of what you're building and where you're building it to understand if there's a Section 2 violation occurring. There are some areas in the state where you may be required to draw a majority-minority district. A majority-minority district is exactly what it sounds like if you piece that together. It's a district where the majority of the population within the district is a member of a minority group. You'll be required to draw one of these districts if the voting age population of that minority group is large, compact, politically cohesive, and the group has traditionally failed to elect its preferred candidates to office. So again, this is sort of the jingles test that I talked about earlier. In order to be required under Section 2 to create a majority-minority district, there is case law that requires that that states that you're only required to do so if a voting age minority population actually constitutes a majority for the district to be drawn. This is the case that came out in 2009 that specified that you're using voting age population rather than the total population of the district to determine whether the group is majority-minority or not. There is an issue related to statistics in figuring out whether you have an effective majority-minority district. And it's something that is really, again, like a lot of things in the Voting Rights Act, is sort of context-based and really requires you to sort of take a look at what you're building and where and what the demographics are of the area. Technically, to build a majority-minority district, all you need is 50% of the people plus one in that district to be members of a minority population to have an effective majority-minority district. But if somebody comes back and shows some statistical analysis that demonstrates that, in fact, you know, members of the minority group don't vote in the same proportion as members of the majority, or if they're not registered to vote, or if they don't participate in the same way, then it could be the case that you're to build an effective majority-minority district, you may need to actually have a higher percentage than just 50% plus one to make the district functional. And again, this is something that you're not necessarily going to be able to tell just by looking at a map alone, whether you have an effective district or not. You're going to have to look at the history of the area and see, you know, what has happened in the area. And in fact, you may need to draw the district the way you want to draw it and see how things go in the future, whether there's a substantial participation of members of the minority within that district to get those their preferred candidates actually elected to office. Section 2 does not require you to actually maximize the number of majority-minority districts that you could draw if you wanted to. There's a requirement, of course, that you have to draw some if there's if the facts on the ground are sufficient to require the drawing of a majority-minority district, but you don't have to spend all of your time coming up with all possible permutations of a majority-minority district and do all of them in order to comply with the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. If there is a substantial opportunity for members of the minority group to elect candidates to office, then that's sufficient. You don't have to, there's no requirement in Section 2 for extra effort to get more candidates elected to office. The requirement is just that you can't dilute their voting strength within the general population. And as I mentioned earlier, Section 2 doesn't require creation of an effective minority district if the minority group doesn't actually constitute a majority of the population within the potential district. And again, that's based on some 2009 case law, is based on the voting age population of that district, not the total population. If you have districts other than majority-minority districts that have the effect of creating an effective minority district, that can help defend against a Section 2 claim under the Voting Rights Act. These types of districts are not districts that are required to be drawn by the federal law, but they can exist, and you can decide to create them if you'd like to. Crossover districts are districts where a minority group is actually still in the minority within the district, but it's close enough to a majority that if they persuaded a few members of the majority group to cross over and vote for the minority's preferred candidate, you could have an effective minority district in that area. Influence districts are districts where there are going to be fewer members of the minority, but they have enough of a population within a particular district so that they have some voice and have some effect on the campaign and have the ability to influence the policy choices of the individual that's ultimately elected to office. Coalitional districts are also districts that could help minimize the risk of challenges under Section 2 if they exist. In a coalition district, you have members of multiple different minority groups that will sort of coalesce and vote for one preferred candidate within that district. So even though one particular group isn't a majority of the population within the district, if you add them all together, they do form a majority and can vote for a preferred candidate. coalitional districts only work, and again, this is a context-based thing. You need to actually see if the different groups within that district actually do create a coalition, and whether they do have the same political interests and act in the same way politically in order for the district to be effective. But it's a possibility, depending on the context and what groups you're dealing with, that you could create a district where no one single minority group is a majority, but all of them added together does constitute a majority. That's a coalitional district. And a lot, there's a lot of data analysis and commentary that you can read related to how you do this analysis and how you figure out whether you have crossover districts or influence districts or coalitional districts. You really need to take a look at all that stuff and look at the context of the map that you're drawing to see if these things are going to exist or not. It's something that there isn't a bright line rule. There's no specific percentage of a group that needs to exist in any one of these types of districts for it to be an effective minority district. It really is based on the groups that you're thinking about and statistics on the ground and the context on the ground to determine whether you're creating an effective minority district. In 2002, just a few statistics on what we had ordered by the Minnesota Supreme Court's special redistricting panel, the districts that are in place right now. In Minnesota, as of 2002, there was one majority-minority House district, that was District 58B. If you're basing that on the total population of one group within a district, if you're going to base it on voting age population, there are actually zero majority-minority House districts as of 2002. There were 11 minority opportunity House districts based on total population in 2002.
Mr. Gearing, sure. Can you give us the details of who are those 11 minority opportunity House sure. districts?
Madam Chair, the 11 minority opportunity House districts based on the reports that were run in 2002 are districts 46A, which had a total minority population of 31.4%, 58A had 41.9% total minority population, 58B had 66.1%, 61A had 53%, 61B had 54.8%, 65A had 57.9%, 65B had 31.7%. 66A had 40.3%, and 67A had 30%. And the way that this was done in 2002, the reports that were run out of Maptitude determined that there was a minority opportunity district if at least 30% of the total population within a district was was a member of a minority group. And so those percentages that I just read out are aggregating all of the different minority groups within a district into one number.
Thank you.
On the Senate and congressional side, in 2002, based on the court's order, there were zero majority-minority Senate or congressional districts. On the Senate side, there were six minority opportunity Senate districts based on the total population of the district. And if you're using voting age population, there were only three. But there, on the congressional side, there were zero minority opportunity districts.
And
all.
Mr. Gearing, I'm assuming that those six majority minority districts are 58, 61, 65, and what else?
Madam Chair, as of 2002, the Senate minority opportunity districts are 46, 58, 61, 65, 66, and 67.
Thank you.
So now we do have some 2010 census results that can give us a little bit better idea of how things have shifted. The majority minority districts that I just read out were those types of districts in 2002. And as we know, the 2010 census results has shown a pretty significant increase in minority populations within Minnesota. So as of right now, using the current set of boundaries within the state, but applying the 2010 census results, there are two congressional districts that would constitute minority opportunity districts, which would be districts 4 and 5. In Minneapolis and St. Paul. There are 8 state senate districts that are minority opportunity districts, and 6 of them are majority minority districts.
Mr. Gearing,
in total.
And of those 6 majority minority, can you give those to us, please?
Madam Chair, I can't. I forgot to print out that list, but I can get it to you after the committee if that's okay.
And Mr. Gearing, is that as the districts stand currently? Or that's based off of the 2000?
Madam Chair, these statistics is based on the 2002 districts that are in place right now.
Okay.
But we're just applying the 2010 census results to those existing districts.
Okay. 2010 census numbers, though.
Yep. Correct.
Okay.
So this is where things stand right now in all the districts within the state.
Okay. Thank you.
So that's kind of an overview of the Voting Rights Act. I'm going to talk really briefly about racial gerrymandering, which is a little bit of an extension of the law. It's not something that's specifically covered under the Voting Rights Act, but it is covered under the Due Process Clause in the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment. Typically, if somebody is going to state a claim for racial gerrymandering, what they're going to claim is that the legislature, when it adopted a redistricting plan, unfairly used racial data as the prominent motive in drawing a districting plan the way that they did. Historically, at least the early history of the use of the challenges based on racial gerrymandering was that state used racial data to unfairly exclude minority groups, but in recent decades, claims have been brought because states have used racial data to increase minority representation within Congress or within the legislature. If it's shown that the race was the primary motive in drawing a district the way the legislature chose to draw it, the Supreme Court will apply what's called strict scrutiny analysis. That means that they'll need to show at the state level that there was a compelling interest in using the racial data the way that it was used, and that the end result was narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. This is based on a 1993 case called Shaw versus Reno that specifically looked at a challenge to a district based on some based on the use of racial data only as the data for drawing that district. So again, with everything else within the world of redistricting, this is all going to be context-based. To determine whether a violation has actually occurred or not. To prove that a district is the result of a constitutionally suspect racial gerrymander, the challenger has to show that that race was, as I mentioned, the dominant motive in creating the district the way that it was created. In doing that, the court is going to look at the shape of the district. They're going to look a lot at legislative history, so they're going to take listen to public testimony on a particular redistricting plan. They're going to listen to statements of legislators and staff and other public records that were created while the plan was being considered and enacted. They're going to take a look at whether racial data was used in the process to create the district boundaries and when it was used. If racial data is the first and primary set of data that is shown to be used to draw the district boundaries, they're going to be more concerned than if racial data is part of a broader set of principles that the legislature uses to draw its boundaries. They're also going to consider whether the district is racially gerrymandered or whether it's politically gerrymandered. This is something that is, there are two distinct concepts, although the results can be sometimes similar. There's no prohibition in the law, there's no prohibition in the 14th Amendment against political gerrymandering of districts, so you can pack particular political parties within a district as much as you want without fear of being challenged on that point, at least the way the case law stands right now. But if you pack racial groups within a district, then you can be subject to challenge under the 14th Amendment. Because political gerrymandering does occur, and because sometimes political affiliation falls along racial boundaries, it sometimes can look like a district is being racially gerrymandered, but in fact the intent was to elect a particular party in that district. So a court is going to take a look at that type of context and see if, in fact, the legislature intended to racially gerrymander the district or whether they intended to gerrymander it in a way that they would win. So if the plaintiff succeeds in showing that, in fact, there is racial gerrymandering at play with a particular district, the court, as mentioned, is going to use strict scrutiny analysis. The test there is whether the government had a compelling interest in creating the district the way it did and whether the district is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. So the compelling interest may be something like remedying past discrimination or intending to comply with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act in some way. To determine whether the actual result of the district was narrowly tailored to achieve the interest, the court is going to look and see if the stated interest first was accomplished, and second, did the actual resulting plan go further than what the actual interest was? So did you comply with the Voting Rights Act more than you needed to? Did you remedy more discrimination than was stated, was your intent as the plan was being created? If you're going further than what was the stated compelling interest of the state, then they may be more suspect, because then there's a potential that the districting plan may not be narrowly tailored to a specific result, but instead could have broader reaching effects, and that can lead to a finding of a violation of the 14th Amendment. So minimizing risk of challenges for a claim of racial gerrymandering. We've talked a lot about this in committee, really, traditional districting principles. Adopting a set of guidelines and plans that you're going to use to actually draw your maps is always a good idea, and in the context of a racial gerrymandering claim can help defend your plan against a 14th Amendment challenge. If the court finds that a district was drawn using racial data, but it was also drawn because in a certain way, and it looks funny because you're trying to preserve political subdivisions, or because you're concerned about a community of interest, or something else that would be within a set of districting principles that are legitimate considerations that the legislature may use in drawing districting plans, the court is going to be more likely to find that the district that appears to be gerrymandered is acceptable. If they can't find a set of districting principles that you used, or if they're trying to make up and sort of speak for you in determining what principles might have been used in the process, they're going to be more suspect of the district. So if you adopt a set of districting principles and comply with them and make that as part of the public record to explain to people why it is you're drawing districts the way you're drawing them, then you're minimizing the risk of a challenge of a racial gerrymander. The avoidance of bizarre shapes is also something that typically has not been an issue in Minnesota, because we do have compactness requirements here. But avoiding something that looks, you know, like a set of earmuffs or like a spider or something like that is typically a good idea in avoiding the risk of a 14th Amendment violation, although there are some bizarrely shaped districts that are drawn specifically that way for legitimate reasons that have been upheld as complying with the 14th Amendment because they were specifically drawn to deal with a community of interest, or because they were specifically drawn to be a majority-minority district. So just because a district looks bizarrely shaped doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad district, but sometimes that can raise additional suspicions by the court when they're taking a look at compliance with the 14th Amendment. And finally, the use of a variety of types of data in developing a plan is always a good idea and would be helpful in avoiding racial gerrymandering claim. Again, you know, you'll get the census data that has racial data in it, but if you're using other types of data when you're developing the maps, and you know, if you're considering political subdivision boundaries or other types of layers within the Maptitude software to develop the plan, again, this is another piece of evidence that you can use to show that you're not actually gerrymandering based on race, but you're considering racial data as part of a broader scheme of principles and standards that you want to use to create effective and fair districts within the state. Madam Chair, that's the end of my presentation. I'm happy to take questions if anybody has them.
Members, any questions for Mr. Gehring? Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Appreciate that. We have Anna Marie Hill from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Are you here today? All right. And then next that we have is Ms. Herr from Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And hopefully I said that correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong. You can come to the table and just state your name for the record. And members and folks in the audience, just so you know, we are in the midst of our finance committee deadlines. And so we have a lot of members that have multiple obligations to be in other committees at the same time that we're meeting. So if you see people coming in and out that are not present, it's because they have another committee commitment. But we will make sure that they have access to the committee tape and are able to see all of the materials that were presented today. Ms. Herb?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eileen Herr, and I'm the Executive Director for the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And I am thankful to be at the table to have this conversation with you, and I do hope that this is the start and not the end all of our working together and figuring out how we can ensure one of the, I think, when I work with my community, the one principle that I love most of all, and that is your vote matters and it counts. And that one vote really does equal one vote, because that's something that I run into from the community all the time. What difference does it make if we vote or don't vote? We're a minority within this larger community, and so we won't really make a difference. But I say, just go out and vote, because then you can complain, right? But I'm here to speak a little bit. I'm not an expert on redistricting, but I do remember being here for the 2000 redistricting plan and our conversations involved in that. And so I do ask that when you look at, in terms of the state races in the Senate and the House, that you look at the gentleman before me relayed, the minority or majority minority districts, and really looking at that and preserving those districts so that the real opportunities. And as you can see, it was not rocket science to figure that out of these opportunity districts, Mimoa came out of 61. Saitau, which was one of your fellow House members until he retired last year, was from 65. And so the majority of Asian Pacific Minnesotans, about 80%, reside in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And about the largest percentage actually reside in the 4th Congressional District. And then equally within the 5th and 3rd Congressional District. So I would highly speak to that. Please do not dilute the voting power of Asian Americans, and within these districts that that you're looking at redrawing lines and redrawing boundaries, that you really look at preserving the voting power of that Pacific community that lives in that area. For example, just use the 3rd Congressional District. In that 3rd Congressional District, in which Congressman Paulson represents, the Asian population from 2000 to 2010 increased by 3%. But we know that that area needs a little bit redrawing or a little bit help. And so you may be borrowing from neighboring areas. And when you look at that, you know, don't, my recommendation is reach for fairness and don't try to borrow from one to pay the other. Or I'm not really good with American phrases, to borrow from Peter to pay Paul or something like that.
We've got you, Ms. Herr. But Ms. Herr, I do have a committee member that has a question, if you don't mind.
No, please jump in.
Ms. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Herr, would you just repeat, in the 3rd District, the Asian population grew by what?
Oh, 3%.
Thank you.
And Ms. Herr, what are the raw numbers for that when you're saying 3% increase? What did it go from?
I don't have the figures per se, but I just have the percentage in change. And let's just say, Madam Chair, in the 3rd Congressional District, in which, again, Representative Congressman Paulson represents, the population of Asian Minnesotans in that district is about 12,000. And then there's a 3% increase. So I'm speculating that increase by 2,000 to 3,000. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense because that's a growing metropolitan suburban area. And we do notice that as the population grows and increases its educational attainment, they move from the inner city in which they came as refugees and move out to the suburban areas. And so it doesn't surprise me that it is within the West Metro area that we see growth in Asian population and movement. And we hear that from Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, that those areas are increasing by leaps and bounds in terms of Asian American students entering their classrooms. So that's just mirroring what we see in the community, but we know that that's where they're living and residing, and that has changed from the 2000 census. So to keep that in mind when we're looking at redrawing the lines.
Ms. Herr, is there a particular community within the 3rd CD that they're residing, or is it scattered throughout Congressional District 3?
Madam Chair, they are kind of scattered throughout. Again, like I said, through in the north, Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, and then down in the south, Plymouth, Wayzata, I think we're starting to see a growth in the numbers of Asians that are moving out there and living there. So they're north and they're south. But it makes a difference when it's only 20,000 and you're moving the line. You could encompass, you could redraw, and then all the community gets put back into, say, Minneapolis, or allowing more space for them to be in, say, the 3rd Congressional District. And so those, they're slight and they're little, but to our community, when our numbers are so small anyway, it does make a big difference.
Please proceed.
I think that's pretty much all I have, in that the real opportunities and the real areas where we can and have made a difference in terms of the Asian American vote has been within the 4th Congressional District, the 5th Congressional District, and now increasingly more important than ever, the 3rd Congressional District, in that, and this is something that within the Asian American community, we haven't done a lot of research on, so we really don't know what is the voting pattern of the Asian American community. We have very active participants in the Republican, Independent, and Democratic Party. So that I myself, being Executive Director of the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, don't have a good understanding myself of what is the voting pattern of Asian American community. So that's something that I think as we go through the redistricting, I'd like to have conversations with the community, just finding them from the sense of, you know, where they define themselves politically on that front.
So, Ms. Herr, would you say that there's not like a coalition to get behind a particular candidate? It's kind of based on an individual basis from what you've seen?
Madam Chair, it has been focused on issue, and the community is really, really issue-driven. The issue that is important to them, that's something that they organize around.
And is that different based upon where you live versus, say, you're in CD3 versus CD5 and CD4?
I would say that that is the case. For example, here I'm maybe overreaching my knowledge, but from my experience of working with the community, from refugee-based communities, they tend to be, the issues that drive them the most tend to be service issues, mm-hmm. And so they're very interested in a lot of the safety network programs that we have, Medicare, Medicaid, the Minnesota Care assistance, just because they're refugee-based, coming to this country with very little job skills and English language skills, that they need that extra push and help and incentive to rebuild their lives here in America. And then other communities that tend to be more affluent or have been here second, third generation, they tend to be more driven by entrepreneur because the entrepreneur spirit is very high in the Asian American community. So that's the issue that drives them, and they will organize around that, around economic or job opportunities, and what's the best platform in which to be entrepreneurial and be successful in Minnesota or in the neighborhood that they live in. So again, like I said, the community is really driven by the issues that impact them and where they want to get the most assistance or the most contribution.
And Ms. Herr, those waves of based upon how long you've been here versus refugee versus maybe being third generation, is there a difference on where they're settled? Like, if you're refugee based, you settle in one neighborhood versus being third generation, and if so, where would that be?
Sure, Madam Chair, I would say unfortunately yes. The newer communities tend to congregate or tend to reside in areas where jobs are, or where housing is more affordable and where there's more easy access to transportation. And so we could say the newest community to Minnesota from the Asian community is the Karen. And the Karen are refugees from Burma, politically persecuted. Most of them came and they resettled in St. Paul. Now that some have been here for about 5 years. Some of them are now moving to the Roseville area. But they tend to congregate in when they first come. And same thing with the Hmong community, and I'm from the Hmong community. When we first came to this country about maybe 25, 30 years ago, we came where there was affordable housing in St. Paul, in Minneapolis. As we became more successful, we moved out to the suburban areas. And that, two ways. One is, of course, affordable housing, and then two is transportation. So when you're on the bus line, it's easier for you to get from your house to your work. And one thing that we hear from the community is that when you're in the suburb, public transportation is just a little bit harder to get access to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Members, any other questions? Do you have a list of the subgroups that are considered under the Asian category with the Census Bureau? Do you have the different subgroups at all?
Madam Chair, yes, I do. And I will make sure that you get that information.
That would be wonderful. And do you have any population estimates for each of those subgroups?
Madam Chair, I do. And I will get that to you, too.
Okay. And then I apologize if there's any other questions. I don't mean to monopolize here. Ms. Herr, as far as like the you talk about the entrepreneurial spirit, so are there certain business districts that everyone goes to in the Asian community, or is that scattered throughout?
Madam Chair, there are in my mind two areas that we do have mom and pop business owners along the University Avenue corridor, mm-hmm. and then also the Lake Street corridor, with the commonly referred to as Eat Street in Minneapolis. And those are tends to be mom and pop stores that do bring in revenue, of course, to their families and the communities. But for the most part, we do have large Asian-owned firms in the state of Minnesota, primarily in the area of high tech, and then also in the medical, biotech area. And those tend to be in the suburbs and spread throughout the metropolitan area. So I couldn't say that they were in one area or so than the others. But along, and I think that's why the University Avenue Central Line Corridor is so very important to the community, because that's where a lot of the mom and pop stores are. They do bring in money, again, like I said, to the family and then to the neighborhood. But in terms of being mid-sized firm or bringing in large revenue, that's not the case for the mom and pop owned businesses, but that is the case for the larger owned companies, like, for example, Shaw Lundquist, which is owned by a Chinese family. That's out in Eagan. Mm-hmm. And then other industries are in the Roseville area, but they're spread throughout the Twin Cities area.
Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Herr, can we go back to talking about political affiliations within the Asian Pacific community? You spoke of Mimoa and Sai Tau. Is there an incubator group to encourage candidates within the communities?
Ms. Herr?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the answer is no. In terms of Asian American incubator or Asian American group that is working really hard. I know that the Republicans have Asian Americans that are very involved in that group. And then in the DFL, there is a strong DFL Asian caucus, but an independent group outside that is trying to work with candidates and train candidates on how to run besides the Wellstone training camps. I can't really think of a large effort for the community, but that's something that is much needed, and that's something that at the council we've given voice to, is that we want the community to be fully engaged, and to, I should step back and say that the Asian American population in the state of Minnesota is about 210,000, and about half of that is refugee-based, and more than 65% is foreign-born. And so when you're foreign-born, you have to adjust your status to become a U.S. naturalized citizen, and then you can vote. And so for our community, there's an extra hurdle in terms of getting them the right to vote, or giving them the right to vote. So we have to go through the citizenship area and then educate the community that what are the benefits of becoming a United States citizen. And among that, of course, is you get to vote. I mean, that's the most precious attribute that you can get. So because of all these barriers, it's been pretty hard to get the community to be civically engaged. And I think that's one of the biggest roles that we play at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, is working with the community to get them civically engaged, to get them to know about the electoral process, to be involved and engaged at all level, as election judges, as people who are volunteering for campaigns, as well as running candidates. And that's one of the issue that is a big point of discussion within the Asian American community right now, in that we used to have two legislators from our community that sat at the House and in the Senate, and now we have zero. So the question of where will they come from? What's going to happen to them? And those two individuals really did it out of themselves. They didn't do it out of an organized training institution, but they ran because they had great ideas, and they ran because they had great will and determination. But within that training within the community, we don't have that. And so the question from the community is, how long will it take until another person rises from the community to be elected? And what will it take to make that happen? And I must say, and I applaud a lot of the members of the House and the Senate who have sat down with me and said, we want to help you reach out to the community in terms of getting them to run, because we will miss that voice. We will miss that point of view from that specific community.
Representative
Chair, Ms. Herr, it could happen in 2 weeks.
Ms. Herr, out of that 210,000 you said in the population, how many are registered to vote, or eligible to vote, I should say, eligible to vote?
Madam Chair, that is something that we don't know. To be honest with you, that is something that I have been working with the Secretary of State on. Just what is the voting power within the Asian American community? Who is voting? We were part of a national effort, and to be honest with you, that number was very small, because when you look at the census or the demographic, the Asian American community is very small, very young. The average age of a Hmong person, which is the largest Asian ethnic group in Minnesota, 1 out of 4 Asian American Minnesotan is of Hmong ancestry. And the Hmong community, the average age or the medium age is 16. So it's a very young, 16, they can't even vote yet. The majority of them are, if the average mean is 16. So for us, out of that, what number is then over 18? Who's a citizen, and then who's registered to vote? When you look at all of that, it becomes very, very small. And I will send you the information, but we are part of a national effort to get out the vote. It's called the Asian Pacific Islander Vote Initiative. And out of that, when they did a national survey of Minnesota, they found that approximately less than 7,000 Asian Pacific Minnesotans were registered to vote, and of the voting age and citizenship. So there's lots of steps to take to make sure that we can actually understand. And out of that, what is their voting preference? Those are things that we need to understand more about the Asian American community. But at the same time, again, like I said, we work with communities on issue, and so we're really, really issue-driven. But at the same time, understanding where they are on the political spectrum would be very, very helpful.
Well, thank you, Ms. Herr. And I have to tell you that Cy Tao is missed here at the Capitol. He had a way of making us realize that we shouldn't take ourselves so seriously here. So thank you for coming, and I appreciate it, and I look forward to the additional information that you'll provide to us. So
great. Thank you.
Okay, and we have Lester Collins, the Council on Black Minnesotans. Mr. Collins, if you could state your name for the record, and welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Lester Collins, and I'm the Executive Director of the State Council on Black Minnesotans. Just as a matter of reference, we were created in 1980 in a very similar period to my other colleagues that are testifying here today. One of the things I want to start off by saying is I don't feel nearly as prepared, I guess, for the kind of specific recommendations today. And as I share with you, I'm going to make a couple of recommendations to the committee that hopefully you will accommodate me on. So I'm going to speak, I think, more general. I don't have the specific kinds. I've been talking to different people in the community in terms of impact, in terms of North Minneapolis. I happen to live in St. Paul and those areas and districts, so I can't be as specific as I would like to be. I would have been, you know, the last time around, this time, just based on any number of things that are going on.
And that's all
not,
right.
Not as prepared as I would like to be in that particular regard.
That's fine, Mr. Collins. You know, any information that you want to provide to us later on, we would be happy to accept it.
And so, I think that's what I'll be doing. It's interesting just looking at the overview that you all just received, and I don't want to repeat that. It was those kinds of things that I had taken the time to research, look at, and many of my comments, which I could provide, you know, which is like one page, kind of touches upon the very things that you were essentially being reviewed or reminded, you know, of. So, I don't want to necessarily repeat those things. For instance, issues around redistricting that impact the black community, which are the same for my colleagues, the way the district lines are drawn, puts voters together in a group, some voters are kept together, that, just those kinds of things. Let me get to my recommendations, so I'll save you some time in that particular regard. I would recommend, and I'm concerned, that once maps, and sometime before then, are drawn, it will be easier to be seen, you know, in terms of what those impacts, you know, actually look like or will be. The example that I would have given is very similar to the one, in fact, probably even drawn, in my opinion, from the same source that I essentially looked at in terms of how the cracking or you know, compacting districts are. So that's the kind of information I looked at. I began to look at North Minneapolis in terms of how, say, perhaps Reverend, you know, which speaks to my weekend in terms of the way I spent it, because we're looking at an economic summit with the governor and mostly ministers that I was talking with, but Representative Hayden and Champion, and for that matter, even Karen's, you know, district, in terms of how they would be impacted. So what I want to recommend, and I'm not sure exactly where this, I was aware of some hearings that you've had, but I'm concerned that the NAACP, the Urban League, and particularly the NAACP and others that have traditionally, and I was even looking at the report that they did some time ago, I have a concern that those individuals, in many respects, although we are essentially a voice, a liaison for them, I think they speak very well to the kinds of concerns, the kind of input that you want. I didn't have at least the kind of time that I wanted. I, you know, invited real quickly some of these folks on very short notice, you know, to attend today. I guess what I'm asking specifically is that there be room or opportunity for a hearing where at least, as relates to, you know, my community in particular, that those individuals are invited to be heard from. I think the input, particularly Minneapolis, St. Paul primarily, that they would give, I think will be very specific, and I think will be more impactful to the kind of information and recommendations you want. So that's one thing I would strongly, you know, recommend. Now, did I just hear that in 2 weeks something, Madam Chair, is about to happen, or did I misunderstand that?
I'm not quite sure what Representative Murphy was referring to. I have to be honest.
No, there might be another, an opening for another candidate to be elected. Oh.
There's a special election in St. Paul, actually. So.
Yeah, I am aware of that.
And Mr. Collins, I was kind of hoping, though, that you could give the flavor of where, if there is a concentrated area for Black Minnesotans that live in certain areas, if you've kind of done a survey of that. You've heard some of the questions that I asked of Ms. Herr as far as if there's business districts, things like that, so we have a better understanding of where the different populations live so that we can make sure that we abide by, you know, the Voting Rights Act and so forth. And I was figuring that you would have that kind of information.
And I do. I don't have that with me today.
Okay. Sure,
I'd like to forward you, that information.
That would be wonderful.
Kind of just begin to formulate, look at that, been in discussions, mm-hmm. With individuals in terms of reviewing that.
Mm-hmm.
I generally know what they are, but, I think I can, much better prepared in terms of what that looks like and what they are.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to forward that information to you.
That would be wonderful and very helpful. Yeah. So we'll just remain in contact. Is there anything else that you wanted to provide at this point? Or?
No.
Okay.
No.
And Representative Hortman has a question, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you. And you had mentioned maybe us doing a little bit more in terms of outreach to make sure that we're communicating to the community that we want to hear from people. And I was wondering if you had suggestions of forums for us to communicate through. I know in the past the legislature has had hearings at the Urban League in North Minneapolis. I don't know if there are other locations or areas where you think that we could conduct particularly effective outreach if we were to travel to the community.
Sure.
If you had suggestions along those lines.
I do, and I could easily, Madam Chair, share
Mr.
with you that
Collins.
Not only the Urban League in Minneapolis, and Representative Clark will tell you that even more often or equally used these days is what is now called the UROC Center, which I think you all may or may not have been to. They're essentially in proximity to one another, so either one of those locations in terms of North Minneapolis, Sabathany Community Center in South Minneapolis, just to name those two, easily in St. Paul. I would say the Martin Luther King or Hallie Q. Brown Center.
Mr. Collins, what would be helpful in this whole process if we could count on you to be our conduit and our communicator when it comes to these issues. We've got posted on the website all of the committee hearings, when they happen, and everything that has transpired so far. If you would be willing to forward that to the different groups that you had mentioned here today and help in us getting the message out. We had a different groups last week. We had the Council of Nonprofits, and the director that came and spoke to us was willing to do that for us. We can make sure, too, that you're on our distribution list of when committee hearings happen. You don't have to come, because I realize that it's not always easy to make it to the Capitol, but certainly you can watch them online, too, and have access to that information. It's just going to be key for us to have that kind of communication network connection that we can have with you on that. And if you can help to foster that with all the different groups, that would be really helpful.
Madam Chair, no problem at all. I consider it a part of our duty and responsibility. So.
Wonderful.
Yeah, gladly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You bet. All right. And then we have Mr. Garcia from the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Good to see you again, Mr. Garcia.
Hello. Good to see you, Madam Chair, and hello, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting us to do a presentation on the growth of the Latino population.
And if you could just state your name quickly for the
record. Certainly. Hector Garcia, Executive Director of the Minnesota Chicano Latino Affairs Council. And we're going to be looking at some screens that we've prepared to all of these figures were taken from Census 2010, I'll mention one particular statistic from Census 2000 because I don't have that figure for 2010, and that's the proportion of the Latino population that is foreign-born, which in 2000 was 40%. I don't have that figure for 2010. You will see that our population has grown dramatically. Over the last decade, there was a growth of 75% from the year 2000, bringing us to a total population in the state of 250,258. In 26 counties, the Latino population more than doubled. Hennepin County was the one that gained the highest number of new Latinos with 32,237. Dakota County was second, and Ramsey County was third.
Mr. Garcia, could I interrupt you for 1 second?
Yes.
I'm looking at the handout, and I'm looking at Red Lake County with the increase there in the Latino population. Can you tell me where it started? What were the raw numbers for that, if you have them by chance?
What page are you looking at?
Just the last page you were on, just the previous page that you were on. I believe so.
Red Lake County experienced the greatest percent increase, 677%.
And do you have the raw figures for that by chance? Or?
Okay. Oh, it was only from 13 to 101, so in many instances there's a very dramatic growth because of the very low numbers of the population.
Okay.
So moving on to the next screen, as you can see, District 1 had an increase of 5.2%, District 2, 4.8%. The population there in those two districts are over 13% of the total Latino population. District 3, 4%, and District 4, 7.6% were the largest percentage of the population of the Latinos is located, and in District 5, 23.4%. So it's the metro area that has the largest number of Latinos in the state.
And Mr. Garcia, within each of those congressional districts, do you know if there are certain communities that carry the bulk of the increase? So say, for example, Congressional District 1, is there a certain town or region within that congressional district?
Well, it would be Worthington would be one of them. St. James would be another one. And I've got some figures on counties that I will be showing you in just a few moments. Getting back to this screen, then District 8 is the one that has the least proportion of the Latino population and the smallest increase of 1.3%. Hennepin County has the largest number of Latinos in Minnesota with 77,676. It had a 71% increase. Had a 71% increase in population from the year 2000. The seven-county metro area has a total of 167,588 Latinos, an increase of 71,000 since 2000. And that makes up approximately 67% of the total of Latinos in Minnesota. The seven-county metro area experienced a 75% growth in its Latino population, and 68 counties had a 40% growth in their Latino population. So here are the counties. Nobles County, 22.5% of the population with the highest representation in the state. 25 counties have a Latino population that makes up 4% of the total population. And the counties in the southern half of Minnesota are the most likely to have a higher level of Latino representation, more so than the ones in the northern part of the state. What I'd like to mention is that since we have such a large proportion of foreign-born Latinos who do not know the political system in the U.S., immigrants, by the way, do not have the same amount of knowledge about the U.S. as refugees do. Refugees are provided with information before they come to this country, whereas immigrants do not. That is something that a lot of people don't realize. So in addition to that, a large proportion of the Latino population has a low level of education. It's their poverty in the country, in their countries of origin, that leads them to move to the U.S. So if you can combine those two facts, then you can realize that their engagement with the political system is minimal. And that is carried over sometimes into the second and third generations for lack of information coming from their parents and grandparents that they should be more politically engaged. That's one of our responsibilities, is to get them to become more politically engaged and to understand the system better. At Rochester a couple of weeks ago, we did a presentation with Senator Nelson and Senator Senjum. Senator Nelson provided an eloquent presentation on the political process to the participants. So that's what we try to do. We try to engage people more and to educate them on not only the political process, but also American culture. And the reason why I brought that up is because it's very important, therefore, that those districts where we have a heavy population not be broken up, because the number of Latinos in those areas will enable us to make it easier for them to understand the process and to become engaged. So the less dispersed they are, the better able we will be to help out in engaging them in the process. Also, the median age of Latinos is 24 years old, as compared to the 40-year-old median of the overall community. This is very relevant in different respects. For one, because they're at the peak of their working years, and they, in a significant way, particularly as they continue to grow at these rates, will be able to sustain the aging overall population of Minnesota, which, as we all know, is a significant challenge. I think basically that's it. Oh, I should add, because of the questions that I heard you expressing, that Latinos are mostly engaged in agricultural work, in meatpacking, in service industries, hospitality, cleaning. As I said earlier, there's a large proportion of Latinos who do not have a high level of education. This is another one of the things that we're trying to address at the council, is how to alleviate the achievement gap in education. On the other hand, they're highly entrepreneurial, very hardworking. Many of them have 2 to 3 jobs. They, as can be demonstrated on Lake Street and in the west side of St. Paul, District del Sol, are evidence of the fact that they can transform an area where they're developing their businesses into thriving commercial areas. As you probably know, those two sites used to be crime infested and were an eyesore for both St. Paul and Minneapolis, and now they're thriving commercial centers. So I think it's in everybody's interest that they do not become marginalized, isolated. So whatever you can do in this committee to prevent that from happening will be good for them and for everybody else.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia. Members, any questions? All right, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And Mr. Hussein Samatar, did I say the last name correctly? I hope so. African Development Center of Minnesota. Could you state your name for the record? Welcome.
I will. I will, Madam Chair. 1 second. We're trying to. I do have a PowerPoint presentation, but I'm trying if I can project for you so you could see it.
Wonderful.
No, it has not come through, and let me just double check, and if not, don't worry about it. Okay. So, send it.
So. And as you, yes, and please feel free to proceed. We'll make sure that we put it on the committee page so folks can have access to it too.
Thank you so much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Hussein Samatar. I am the founder, sorry, and the executive director of the African Development Center. We are social profit, community economic development. I am a banker by training, so very linear thinker. If anything else, it would be very hard for me to understand. So I will give you a lot of data, and I will tell you a little bit about the African communities, where they are at, and a little bit about the organization, and then I will definitely leave with you a couple of recommendations. My PowerPoint presentation is coming up while that is happening, and let me just be getting into it. We are a community economic development based in Minneapolis, but we are statewide, called the African Development Center of Minnesota. Before I talk to the mission and what we do and who we work with, let me preface to say our ideology so everybody on the committee knows it. We believe that in this country, no matter what country that you're from, you're not going to build a wealth without the work. You have to participate, and participate hopefully effectively. Second, we also believe that the jobs and the prosperity, especially the jobs, are created in the private sector. We don't claim to create. We are enabling people to participate, which we want all the new American community from Africa to participate. We also don't believe that the government creates the jobs. The government creates the environment within which the jobs can happen. So therefore, we ask the community to effectively, as much as possible, to participate the marketplace and understand how things work. Now, my presentation is the organization, as I said it, we are not social service. We are community economic development organization. But before I even start, we are just, I understand Lester came before us. Let me be also saying 1 point. The African American community, especially the new communities, extremely benefited the people who came before us. We couldn't be doing what we do for living, living in a country that our skin color does not matter that much anymore. It's about the content. Obviously, race is an issue in this country. We all know that. But we feel that we are extremely grateful, the traditional African-American community, who came before us, so thus we don't have to deal with those issues, but focus on raising the families and becoming part of the landscape of the state of Minnesota. Let me say that. Now let me go to the organization. We are Community Economic Development, and the mission of the organization is to start help the African communities to start businesses, sustain them, and build wealth through, again, as I said it, hard work and invest back to the communities. We do that through three different things. One is business development, that's business planning, lending, and training. We are number one small business lender in the city of Minneapolis for the last 3 years. Number one small business lender. We have done more micro lending than Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank combined in the city of Minneapolis. So we are all about micro-lending in the city of Minneapolis. But also I will tell you what we do statewide also. We do first-time home buyer training, and we have trained over 400 families last 2 years, first-time home buyer training. And also we do financial education. We own our own building in Riverside, on Riverside and 20th, the other side of the Carlson School of Management. It used to be a grocery store, bought it, rehabbed it. And we also have a fine African and African-American art. Hopefully sometime you can stop by. We also have a small coffee shop called Afro Deli and Coffee. Predominantly, the students access that deli shop. Now, on our housing side, we have crossed over to the mainstream organizations. 50% of the people who come and participate are the mainstream or the white community, 50%. So that we have crossed over in terms of reaching out to the larger community. We also, as I said, do lending. Our lending is about 4 million now portfolio, started with 25,000 about 5 years ago, and we have about 155 businesses in them, in that small portfolio. Again, I said, next page, you will see that we do the first-time home buyer training. And finally, I will touch the financial education side of it. You know, in this country, it's extremely tricky to participate in the market if the language that you speak is not English. If you have not grown up in the community, even that is going to be very tough to understand the finances and the financials of the United States. So we help people to understand specifically their credit score, but also understand that they're not going to build a wealth without having good credit. Hopefully we help them as much as we can. And we train families, and then we ask the families to go back and train themselves so the wealth does not stay the people we train. Now, next slide, the title is Outreach. We are a statewide organization. Again, as I said it, the headquarter obviously is in Minneapolis, but we have a second office in Mankato, Minnesota. Mankato, Minnesota, second office. And last Friday, we opened our third office in Rochester, Minnesota. You know, Rochester is a growing community, and we believe it's going to become a regional hub, not only for Minnesota, but also Midwest. Therefore, we are there, and there's a large African community and growing there. And we were pleased that Senator Carla Nelson and Mike Benson, Representative Mike Benson, to be able, also Representative Tina Liebling, to join us and come and celebrate with the community. We appreciate it for them to be out there. And the next slide is just tells you overall where the African communities are. But now, let me give you some context. I'm sure you will enjoy this, which is Minnesota Then. That's the title, Minnesota Then Page. And what goes around comes around. Diversity is not different for something now coming from the Asian community or the African community or the Latino community. Minnesota has seen and been dealing with immigrants all over for a long, long time. What I have here is that 1896, if you go out and vote, there were 9 language instructions of how to vote in the state of Minnesota. And they were English, German, Norwegian, Swedish, Finnish, French, Czech, Italian, and Polish. 1910, 60% of the population of Minnesota were foreign-born, 60%. 1910, 23 foreign language daily were available to the community of Minnesota in 1910, 23 of them. I live in the Philbus neighborhood, and I have to mention, Karen Clark is my state rep, and in my own community, one of the finest buildings we have is the American Swedish Institute. And that building is donated by a man who made his money selling the largest Swedish language circulation daily throughout the United States. So that tells us what I'm saying to you is that what goes around comes around. We're not different than the Norwegians, the Swedish, the Germans who came before us. It's the source where we're coming from is different, but the goal is the same. We want to raise the families, we want to go to school, learn the language. By the way, English language is very funny and difficult. But nevertheless, all of us, we get to know and understand it, learn it, and deal with it. So that is essentially the story of it. But now, if you look at the next slide, there are only 7% of the people are of foreign born. It's only less than 7% in the state of Minnesota. This was 2009. And we are calculating, Madam Chair, the new numbers, and I will send it to you. Now, redistricting is all about numbers. Now I have to give you a lot of numbers. Excuse me, I don't love to give you a lot of statistics, but now it's the numbers. If you look now, the foreign-born population of the state of Minnesota has been going up ever since 1970s. And just so you see, it's going up and up and up. But the next slide, you would see that Minnesotans immigrants are not that high percentage-wise. Immigrants actually do go to other states such as New York, California, and Texas, where the weather is a little bit forgiving. But those who do not really care about the weather and just want to be dying to be part of Minnesota come over here and stay. So, but overall, the numbers are not that high in terms of the newcomers. Another number I will give it to you is the next slide would be Africa actually has much more of a source of immigrants than any other community in the state of Minnesota. And if you look at the numbers of 2009, you see that the Africa jumps up more of the Asian community, even the European community, the Latino community, and other communities. So there are a lot of African immigrants coming to the state of Minnesota. Next slide will tell you that the since within the specifics of course early 1990s there were not a lot of African immigrants in the state of Minnesota, and then you have 2000 came and you saw the numbers. But 2010, as the numbers come out, it will be much more, even higher. So that is the numbers as going up. The next one I just want to show to you really that the African immigrants now comprise about half of all of the immigrants coming to the state of Minnesota. Let me say this. The African immigrants are at least half, not more, of the immigrants coming to the state of Minnesota. But nationwide, nationally speaking, throughout the United States, they are only about 11%. So there are something going on here. A lot of Africans are actually making the choice, and I'm sure it's all about the weather. They're making the choice to come to the state of Minnesota. But that's not the case nationwide. If you go to the next slide, the pie chart will show you that actually the Twin Cities, the metro, this is the Twin Cities and the metro, really that the Africans, and also remember, counting the African immigrants is extremely difficult or tall order because they are becoming part of the black community and the African American community. So therefore, as you know it, it's extremely difficult of where to draw the line, who is African, who is an American, and where you draw the line. First generation, second, third. So that complicates a little bit for the African immigrants. But nevertheless, they are becoming part of the African-American community. But if you look at the numbers, Africa within the Twin Cities has a large number and coming. And the United States, overall of U.S. numbers are not big. The Latino community is still the leading source of new people for the United States, followed by the Asian community nationwide, but in Minnesota, the Africans are the leading group coming. The next slide, I gave it to you a breakdown of the numbers that are coming from the African community. The Somalia is number one, Ethiopia, Kenya, Liberia, Nigeria, and then the rest of Africa. Those are the largest community of the state where people are coming from. Then I also touched about the African community. Some of them are highly educated, actually have more higher education than Native Americans. But then you have people like from Somalia, due to civil war, and Liberia, who are less educated than the rest of the African community coming to the state of Minnesota. Then also you need to know about employment. If you see that the African immigrants are extremely entrepreneurs, which I'm going to touch finally, but also they are involved and participating the labor market as is. Most of them, almost all of them, if they are here more than 5 years, they tend to participate the labor market, and they are in the market either seeking a job or having a one. Then I give you numbers of where the African immigrants you will see dominating the sectors that they work in, which is the education. It's a big deal because of their children attending it. And especially nowadays, for the last now 5 years, the Africans are extremely in love with charter schools, setting up new ones, coming up different ways. But nevertheless, they are in education. Healthcare is another sector that they're in. A large number of children of the African immigrants are becoming part of the healthcare sector. And obviously, as you have heard from the Asian community and the Latino community, the Africans are dominating the retail, the small businesses in this community. Now let me give you overall the picture of the state of what's happening with an African community. African communities, they are not, unless they are refugees and they need the social network to survive. Family member, when you get to go to work, you can live with the children, or somebody who have that social value and connections with you in terms of just to make it, then they tend to be one place. And the largest number you will find in one group would be Cedar Riverside, West Bank. That is would be a large place where people live. And I think that's a Senate District 59, my assumption is. You would also find a large number in the district of Representative Karen Clark, 61A, 61B2, the whole Senate District 61. There is a large and growing African community there. But also they are in Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, Eden Brady, Egan, throughout Blaine. You will find a large and growing African community there. But this is also what's happening, I think. Although the black community in the state of Minnesota is extremely diverse, you also know that the African community, the Africa itself, is a very diverse continent. It's a continent that you have all religions, all colors. You could be white and African. You could be black and an African. You could be Catholic and African. You could be Muslim and African. So just to give you perspective, it's a very diverse and fascinating continent. So the people, when they come over here, they tend to really see the whole race relations a little bit different than the traditional African-American community. And that's where you will find, for them, it's almost all about opportunities, jobs, education, and where they can live with their children. Therefore, the reason my organization is traveling throughout the state is we have a large and growing African community in St. Cloud, which we do business, in Wilmer, Minnesota. If anybody's from Wilmer, you know that downtown Wilmer is becoming an African hub. Downtown Wilmer, if you just lately have been there. Owatonna is another city. Marshall is another city. Mankato, that we have office in another city. And finally, where we opened the office, Rochester, Minnesota, the numbers about 5,000 of new Africans are living in the state of Rochester due to, of course, the Mayo Clinic and also other services that they can provide. But in terms of entrepreneurship, the numbers of Africans starting small businesses are unparalleled for the last 5 years now than any other ethnic group. They start more small businesses. Within the African community, the Somali American community tends to start more businesses than any other also within the African community. All the commercial corridors, see the Riverside, Nicollet, University, Lake Street, you will find small businesses scattered around all those issues. And that's why they made us as organization number one small business lender of the city of Minneapolis for some time. The average median income is about $31,000 for the Africans, but if you're refugees, it's about $15,000. Finally, the buying power of Africans in the state of Minnesota has been climbing and climbing and climbing. The Somali American community, they have over $216 million buying power. Ethiopians followed, Kenyan followed, and so on and so forth. Our partners of us as an organization has been predominantly the private sector, especially the financial institutions, Wells Fargo and Bremer Bank. We work in the greater Minnesota because they get it. It's about community that's growing it. It's the services that they want to access. We want them, the community, to be bankable, and the banks, they want the community to be bankable. So that has been a good thing. And finally, my final slide, if you combine the African immigrants and their children, just combine them, their gross domestic product, GDP, as a standalone country, they will be the sixth largest GDP after Morocco if you combine them as a country. The African immigrants and their children in the United States of America, if you combine them, their GDP is about $45 billion. I'm just going to go macro level so you understand it. Everything that I say is on our website. Madam Chair, I talked a lot, but that's all I have for you.
It was wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Somatai. I really appreciate this input, and it was very thorough, and it was exactly what I was looking for. So I really appreciate all of the information. I'll be looking at your website as well. Members, any questions? If not, thank you, everyone, for today. Oh, I'm sorry. I was too quick, wasn't I? Representative Poppy.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I'm just curious. Thank you. This is very good information, very, very thorough. I'm just wondering about a social profit community developer. What exactly is that?
I am so thrilled that you asked that question. We are, as an organization, everybody calls themselves not-for-profit. We're not against profit. We want to make a profit. If the private sector doesn't make a profit, nobody is going to be paid. So we call ourselves social profit instead of non-for-profit. Why? We own the building. We are in it, which we make money out of it. We have started a coffee shop, as I said, the Afro Deli and coffee shop. We're buying a building in Wilmer, Minnesota. We want to make money. And the goal is this organization now 25% to 30% of our operating budget is a fee income. Eventually, we want to be 70%, meaning if we're asking our clients to be bankable, if we're asking our clients to build a wealth, they got to look around and say, what are you doing? How you are sustainable? That's what we mean social profit. We are all about profit and not against profit.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And members, with that, we are adjourned.